Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thina Narduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. What's new with you? Any interesting reading?
Am I allowed to mention something that was in the TLS?
Of course. I think you're contractually obliged.
I was using a very interesting publication. I was really interested this week is that we got a letter from the widow of Borges, because remember we talked to David Gallagher, who was talking about Jay Perini, who had written a book which he said was an account of his trip into the Highlands with Borges in the 1970s, and David Gallagher said, this sounds a bit iffy to me. And then we had more letters in the TLS saying, oh no, I met them when they were on that trip.
Yes, someone said that he saw the pair drinking pints in a Highlands pub.
Yeah, which is exactly one of the things that David Gallagher thought, it was pretty unlikely. And then Jay Perini, I think, wrote in and said, no, we really did make that trip. And now the widow of Borges himself has written us a short letter saying, Jay Perini's book should be considered as fiction. There was a trip to the Highlands, but I was on that trip. A trip to St Andrews, I think she said.
Mm.
So the plot thickens. It's becoming very Borgesian. It's very circular and labyrinthine and all sorts of things.
And probably quite fraught, really, because Borges's widow, Maria Codama, she told an Argentinian newspaper in the middle of last year, this is what David Gallagher mentions in his piece, La Nación, that she was with Borges on that trip to St Andrews and she has no memory of Perini. But she also says that if the book comes out in Argentina, she will have to act in some way or another because I cannot permit it.
Mm.
So it's all quite tense, isn't it?
It is. And I suppose, it's all happening on the TLS letters page as far as I can tell.
I'm beginning to think we need to get Bellingcat on the case.
I'm sure they've been listening as well.
They don't have more important things to do. Well, coming up on this week's show, what made the life of the little-known 20th century German industrialist and writer Hasso Grabner so absurd? And how to tell the tale when the facts are so thin on the ground? A strange new book by the German writer Francis Nennick, translated by Katie Derbyshire, takes on the challenge. And Anna Aslanyan will fill us in. And we have a semi-regular feature in the TLS known as rereading, in which a writer returns to a favourite or somehow pivotal book. This week, the novelist Andrew Michael Hurley has picked up his heavily annotated old copy of Larkin's Wits and Weddings. Alice Wadsworth, who commissions the series, will tell us more. But first, Lucy, over to you.
One of the biggest non-fiction books to be published this year is already out. You may have heard about it. Bill Gates has written a book called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster: The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. It has received a huge amount of coverage and been picked over by politicians, climate scientists, and, well, almost everybody. We asked the economist and author Anne Pettifor, whose most recent book is called The Case for the Green New Deal, to write about it for us. And we're delighted that she's joined us today to talk it through. Anne, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
There's a big subject. We've got a lot to tackle, haven't we?
Yeah, indeed.
To start with, could you please just lay out what sort of book this is? Is Bill Gates pointing out problems, or is he proposing solutions, or both?
So this is an easy to read and accessible book, and it's to his credit that it is. It's not very long, and it is proposing solutions. It's full of solutions, and those solutions are mainly technological. But having said that, you know, he writes in a very accessible style, and he makes sense of this technology, and he communicates it in a way that even I can understand. So that for me is what is good about the book, is that it is, you know, it is for the public to read. And I suppose the other really important thing about the book is that he's written it, and that it has the title that it has, and that it's had the impact that it's had. So it's very good to see it be so mainstream that someone like Bill Gates can write a book and get it so widely publicized.
So, as you say, he's a great believer in technology finding the way, isn't he? But you point out that there are dangers in the very example he uses, which is the Haber-Bosch process and the use of fertilizers in agriculture. Can you unpick that for us a bit?
Well, he thinks of our emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, as being like filling up a bath, and the bath is gradually, the levels of the bath water are rising and rising and getting to a point where, you know, it's going to spill over and be catastrophic. And his answer is to apply all sorts of technology to slow the emissions that are filling the bath. And what he doesn't do is to pull the plug on the emissions and say, we just have to stop emitting. Rather, he would like solutions that slow the trickle, if you like, of emissions so that it doesn't actually overflow. And so he suggests all kinds of technologies, one of which is fertilizer. But he fails to take into the account that in order for us to reuse this technology, quite often we have to, for example, burn steel. And steel requires much hotter and bigger amounts of fossil fuels than almost any other manufacturing process. So it's as if we can go on creating all this new technology and not have an impact. And I find that's what's sort of delusional about the book. And then he picks on fertilizer, and there's a picture of him at a fertilizer factory in Dar es Salaam in East Africa. Now I know Tanzania really well. So he goes to a fertilizer factory, and he has a picture taken of himself sort of like a little kid jumping up, you know, and down in front of all this fertilizer, celebratory. And of course, we need to remember that he himself is a farmer. He owns more farmland than any other American.
That's an extraordinary fact that came very much as a surprise to me. You wouldn't think of Bill Gates as the biggest owner of farmland in the US.
Yes, and he doesn't talk about it very much. He's quite quiet about it. But that's what happens when you make billions. You've got to put it somewhere, and so you buy land. And land is an extraordinarily profitable thing to buy because it always generates rent in some form or another. And he no doubt applies fertilizer on the land, or his farmers do it, because I don't imagine for a moment that he does the actual farming. But anyway, what he fails to show is that this fertilizer really disrupts the structure of the soil ultimately. And I'm no expert in agriculture, but I have a friend, a dear friend, her name is Vandana Shiva. She's world renowned for her work on the Green Revolution, which is what she and thousands, millions of Indian farmers have lived through. And she makes the clear point that ultimately fertilizer depletes the soil of its nutrients, and it pollutes water with nitrates and pesticides. And to be fair to Bill Gates, he comes to this conclusion in the book as well, that actually, much as he loves fertilizer, it's not going to be practical. And then in a footnote, he points out that Fritz Haber, the man that invented, together with his colleague Bosch, invented fertilizer, was also, he says, Fritz Haber had a complicated history, and I quote, in addition to his life-saving work on ammonia, he pioneered the use of chlorine and other poisonous gases as chemical weapons in World War I. And Vandana, when she refers to fertilizer, she refers to it as war chemicals made from fossil fuels. She calls them war chemicals made from fossil fuels.
That was the other thing, isn't it? Because the fertilizer, with the Haber-Bosch process, made the crops much more productive. Yes. But you have to get the gas out of the ground to make it, use the energy to make the stuff. And then, as you say, so you do have a higher yield for a certain amount of time, but then it runs off and pollutes the rivers and the land. But you say he does recognise that.
He recognises that and he pulls back from fertiliser. But he's like a kid with a toy, you know. He loves technology and he loves all these new technological solutions. And we know people like that. We know blokes like that, don't we? And they're most lovable and they have done wonderful things.
There are women like that too, can I just
there
say?
There are women like that too, for sure. But the point is they have to be restrained. So I way back in time, before you were probably born, I was having to learn how to use all this new software. And I struggled. And I have to say that Bill Gates and Microsoft presented the software in a shape that I could understand and I could work with, really. Whereas all my friends who were working in the open source community, you know, I couldn't make sense of all their coding. It was all too much for me. So, you know, he has to be credited with actually making the stuff simpler, but he oversimplifies and he refuses to face the fact that actually we cannot go on digging up rare earths, finding these scarce minerals in places like the Congo, and burning coal in order to grow steel, in order to build robots and all that sort of thing. So it's that which I find worrying about, his obsession, if you like, technology.
There's another aspect to it, isn't there, of the tech leading the way. You have a big problem with the way with the intellectual property rights that those big corporations wield. Can you tell us how that affects climate change?
Well, it doesn't in this way, in a sense that intellectual property rights are a powerful weapon for earning rent. For anyone who invents anything, basically. Now, we all believe in a certain amount of intellectual property. We all want Elvis to have been able to collect, and his family, to collect some revenues from the thing that he created. But we have rules about limiting intellectual property. And what's happened over the last 30 years is that it's been expanded. So intellectual property laws, of course, not confined to one state. They are global. And Bill Gates has been able to hide behind these laws, if you like, to sell computers, to sell software into Asia, Africa, you know, Europe, and have the American state defend his interests. Now, the thing about that is that that's not really capitalism, because if you think about capitalism, if you were a farmer growing tomatoes in the United States, and you went to market and too many people were growing tomatoes and the price of tomatoes fell, the state does not come to your aid. The state does not guarantee your price for those tomatoes. But in the case of Bill Gates, the state enforces the price by enforcing intellectual property law. And that's how people like Bill make such fabulous sums of money. They invent something new, a bit of new software, something like an app, you know, a piece of technology, and they get it stamped with intellectual property law. And then wherever that piece of property goes in the world, they can affix the price. And if you don't adhere to that price, the American state comes after you. I'm not against intellectual property laws. It's a very bad thing when it guarantees prices for certain products and then prevents those products from becoming available to everybody because the price is artificially maintained at very high levels. And Bill Gates has excelled at that strategy, and that is what's made him so very, very wealthy.
And so also, I mean, further down the line, the ironic twist is that this man who professes a love for innovation is stifling innovation.
Indeed, you know, that is precisely that. If I can't compete because there is a product out there and my new little invention, which I haven't got billions behind, is struggling to make its way because it's more innovative, cannot normally get past these huge monopolies. They're just become enormous monopolies, big oligopolies actually.
And you say that so the fact of Bill Gates belonging to the 1% of billionaires is very much part of the problem, because you quote this statistic that 10% of the global population cause 50% of the world's emissions. Is that right?
That's right. And I must say that's my biggest beef, really, because the whole book is premised on the fact that you and I, the little people, do this. We grow things. We move around. You know, we keep warm. And that's the problem the world is facing, because we want to keep warm, because we want to grow things, because we want to move around. And so you read the book and you think, oh my goodness, I ought to be doing something about moving around, growing things and keeping warm. And the idea that all these billionaires in their private planes are flying to Davos, for example, that was so blatant when it happened, and then are lecturing us, the little people, to cut back on our emissions or to invent some new or buy some new technology, something that they're producing. Because the other point about the book is that almost all of the technologies he recommends are technologies that he's invested in. So this is almost, this book is almost a portfolio of his investment, but this issue of, the crowd and the little people must behave themselves, but we, the big people, the 1%, there's only so few of us, so we can't be doing that much damage. Scientists are showing that actually, if we curtail the emissions of the top 10%, even better, of the top 20%, if we stop people going on exotic holidays every year, for example, splashing the cash, then we could do something about emissions in a very short period of time. To focus on the rest, on the 80%, the 90%, or the 70%, is to give ourselves an almost unmanageable task and an unachievable task, and we're bound to fail at it, and then we'll all be blamed.
I'm going to defend the billionaires now at this point. I'm just going to try and put the counterpoint to your argument. Yeah. Bill Gates says he is aware that he is an imperfect messenger about climate change. He has invested, as you say, it's the book is like a portfolio of his investments, but he has put his money in it. As you say, he's invested billions of dollars into admittedly new technologies, but they are new technologies to try and tackle real problems. And he has also made huge reductions in malaria transmission across the world using technology and science. So there is an argument that says, hang on, he's doing the right thing. He's moving in the right direction. And it's fair enough for him to try and do that since he's done it pretty successfully with malaria.
If Fritz Haber had a complicated history, so does Bill Gates. And I absolutely agree with you about that. I worked in Africa. I worked closely with people from the Gates Foundation. And there is no doubt that there are plenty of billionaires that have not chosen to invest their money in projects like, ending malaria. Pharmaceutical companies were totally reluctant to do so. And Bill has kind of pushed and shoved and influenced and in order to get that changed. So that's why I'm ambivalent about the man. But not about the big issues. And because he's not alone, as one of the 1%, all of the 1% share this view that actually they're allowed to go on with their living standards and with their ambitions and doing what they do. And the rest of us have to mitigate and adapt. He belongs to a group that thinks like that, but he is not like all the rest of the group. I would concede that.
Mm-hmm. And is it because, so let's say he only chooses to look at the innovation side of things because that's what he does, that's what he's always done. Yeah. Is it part of the problem, do you think, that he basically doesn't want to get involved in politics or economics? He talks a little bit apparently about more corporate responsibility, but he's not saying, why don't all the huge corporations pay a bit more taxes? That's one thing you suggest. If they paid some more taxes, then the governments would have more money to deal with things like climate change, that kind of thing. Is that part of the problem, that he doesn't want to engage in any of that?
Yeah, and for good reason. One of the great privileges that Bill Gates has is that he can move his money across borders without any hindrance whatsoever. If you and I want to go to Europe or to, especially now in the age of a pandemic, or to the United States, we encounter a lot of friction at the border, passports, filling in forms, visas, all of that stuff. He faces no such friction for the movement of his capital. And nor do any of the other huge global Silicon Valley platforms. And as a result, they can make money in one continent and dump the profits in another, in a haven, a tax haven. And they all do it. And Microsoft does it too. Microsoft has got a huge amount of money and he has boosted the gross domestic product of a small place called Ireland. really. Gross domestic product far exceeds the capacity of the Irish people, right? Because he and Apple and others have shunted their money there. And they have that because of this enormous power that we have granted, politically granted, to these big corporations. And that makes it harder for countries to deal with climate breakdown, because, you know, they've got to invest a great deal in transforming their economies away from an addiction to fossil fuels. And that means compensating shareholders of coal mines, compensating the workers of those coal mines, retraining the workers and helping them move into different spheres. All of that takes a lot of money. The other thing about him, he is quite boyish, and he is like a boy who really loves this stuff, this technology. And it is exciting, I can see, and I know engineers who do get excited by this stuff and who don't like the messiness of politics and you know, society and so on. And I mean, we all share that, you know, politics is pretty bloody awful at the moment. Who wants to get in there, you know? But on the other hand, politics is power. Politics is what gave him that power. And standing away from it is, on one hand, you know, touching and sweet. On the other hand, it's a form of collusion.
Mm. I'm just fantasizing about the kind of change that he could enact, given the huge amount of land that he owns in the US alone. Mm. Just what could be achieved with that ownership in terms of changing things on a more local, you know, national basis, in terms of the way we farm and distribute food. And all, I mean, does he go into the food side of things or not?
Well,
really?
He does a bit on the growing side, but it's always about Africa and those poor countries, because they don't have enough, their productivity levels are too low. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't know enough about the science of this, but we do know that the soil draws down carbon. But it only does that if it's, you know, if it's healthy soil. Mm. There's a wonderful movie out on Netflix, and I've forgotten what it's called now, but it's about how if you grow healthy soil and with plants which develop long roots ultimately and absorb carbon and hold carbon, you know, you can do an awful lot to deal with emissions. You can absorb those, that you can draw them down and into the soil, and it's a good thing. And in fact, that is what the soil does largely. But if the soil is just dirt or dust, because it's been stripped of its nutrients and of its complexity, if you like, then it doesn't serve as a extractor of carbon from the atmosphere. So as the biggest landowner, you know, farm landowner in the United States, he could play an enormous role in drawing down carbon. And, you know, we'd love him even more for that.
Bill Gates, if you're listening.
And if it's love that he's after.
Yeah. Oh, he can have our love for that, no problem. Yeah. Can I ask you then, Anne, if we shouldn't be listening to Bill Gates on how to avoid a climate disaster, who should we be listening to?
Well, I'm back with Greta Thunberg here. We should be listening to the scientists, really. And the one I particularly listen to is Professor Kevin Anderson, who is at the Tyndall Centre at Manchester University and who's an advisor to the IPCC, and who is brutal about how much we have to change in order for civilization to survive. And I think, although we're all talking about the climate, very few of us are talking about the possibility of civilizational collapse. And because that sounds grandiose and too big and too alarming, really. But he doesn't hesitate to talk about that. And the other scam is the term net zero. Net zero means I can carry on doing what I'm doing as long as I'm also planting trees somewhere, basically, and as long as I'm offsetting my emissions. And a load of really big companies do that. The problem is there's a finite amount of space on Earth in which to grow trees to offset. I mean, BP are saying that, Shell say that, right? And then, you know, all the big corporations and the airlines all say that. And one of the things that bugs Professor Anderson the most, we should not be talking about net zero. We should be talking about zero emissions, that, you know, we have to get down to stop emitting this poisonous stuff, because not only is it bad to carry on filling up the bathtub, but once you fill up the bathtub, it's very hard to empty it. The stock of emissions are out there and they're forming a blanket around our planet. basically. And so the more we pump them up, the more we add to it, the more we pump up an existing stock. And Bill, in this book, doesn't make the distinction between emissions, the flow of emissions, and the stock of emissions. You know, the flow of emissions is going into a bath that's pretty much already full of the stock of old emissions, really. So you know, I'm very much in favor of pulling the plug and going after zero emissions, which is what Professor Anderson argues as well.
Okay, then that's our mission. Pull the plug.
Zero emissions, pull the plug.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Anne Pettipour, for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come on the show, a strange new book takes on the life of Hasso Grabner, an industrialist come prolific writer of prose, poems and plays who died in obscurity in 1976. And we consider the questions and challenges that can bob to the surface on rereading certain books. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, this is a gentle reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast for free via your preferred podcast provider, and you'll never miss an episode.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we get to Hasso Grabner, who I suspect would be very surprised to find himself mentioned quite so much on a podcast in the 21st century, we are joined by Alice Wadsworth, here to talk to us about rereading books. Hello, Alice.
Hello, dear.
Now, as I said before, this is a semi-regular feature in which writers choose a work to re-engage with. And Andrew Michael Hurley, his choice this week, Philip Larkin's The Whitsun Weddings, it's interesting also for the fact that he's going back to it from the perspective of a teacher, isn't he? So he's thinking about its value to himself personally, as well as to a cohort of students he's long since lost touch with.
Yes, he's looking at his copy that he first got when he was a new teacher 20 years ago, which is heavily annotated in a way that he says was because he was anxious to pass on the correct interpretations, and at that time kind of thought about it in that way a bit more, and translating the text for his students. And he says that these first kind of round of students were born around 1985 when Larkin died.
It's interesting, I think, that he sees himself as a translator. It's translating across time, basically, because he thinks that the world that Philip Larkin is documenting in his poems is just so alien to these people who were born in 85, 86. I incidentally was born in 86 and I don't find it that alien.
Yeah, I was also taught at A-level actually. So I'm not too far off the age group he kind of scans, because he talks about it starts in 85 and then around to people born in the millennium. He uses the word translate more widely, but he also talks about translating specific terms, like explaining what a guinea is, or a porter, or brie nylon, which isn't a term I would have known either.
Brie nylon. I'm so old.
Brie nylon.
I'm sorry. Exactly. I know how you say it. That's how old I am.
Brie nylon sounds like a kind of cheese substitute.
Brie nylon sounds much nicer.
Alien, yeah. It is to me.
Yeah. That's a good thing, to be honest. So, Alice, when you studied it yourself then at A level, because he says he finds himself he's sort of amazed that they're teaching this very world-weary, sort of, in some ways, very cynical view of humanity, you know, to people who not only they're not fed up with life, but they haven't even kind of got in there yet. Did you find yourself relating to the concerns or thinking, you know?
I didn't find him a hugely relatable protagonist when there were things that seemed like it was from his perspective. But when Hurley talks about the big themes that he's addressing, like love, death, fear, and specifically talking about afternoons, which is young mothers in the park, kind of with their fear or expectation of what's being decided for them and pushing them to the side of their own lives. There was definitely parts of that, but in a kind of overdramatic teenage way, because this is A-level, I'm sure a lot of people felt they were relating to certain things.
There are others that deal with the big things, that, you know, that when they deal with death or loneliness or, you know, and some of these things that actually anybody can relate to them, teenagers just as well as, if not better than. And also we can just admire it as a work of art without, you know, feeling something similar.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, because sometimes there's just a beautifully put sentence that appeals beyond. And that's actually what Hurley then talks about later when he's discussing how Larkin is pretty problematic, was very racist in his personal life in lots of ways, and separating that from the kind of universal truths or appeal of something, you know, that is an art and poetry.
And in that respect, he's really, I mean, by teaching something like that at A level, you're sort of setting your students up for that inevitable difficulty that we all face in our lives at some point, or for the duration of our lives, when we have perhaps loved an artist or loved a particular work of art that is then changed through realizing that you don't love other aspects of their life, of their views.
Yeah, because if anything, the poems that we learn around A level or in school are probably the ones we will end up going back to, at least thinking about in different ways throughout our lives, because they've been pushed in there at such a formative period.
And rereadings these pieces, this series of pieces, they often tend to open out in this sort of way, don't they? I mean, the books becoming a kind of jumping off point for other thoughts and ideas that quite often carry you quite far from where you think you're going. There's a particular a recent piece by Alexander Starrett. He's rereading One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and it was particularly moving and unexpected.
Yes, it was really unexpected and really beautifully written. He contextualized it within around the meeting of his parents, talking about how they met through a chance encounter that was followed by an acoustic jam session that he's actually still heard a recording of. Kind of on maybe the second day they met. And this book was given to his mum by his dad when she first arrived in the UK from Germany. So it might be the first time that someone's called it a nice short read with simple sentences, but this was the reason why his dad gave it to his mum, because she was still, you know, getting more proficient with English and reading in English. And I think the way he frames it is particularly beautiful, because he read it first at the age of 11, and it leads him to have a teacher kind of think that maybe he'll recommend him other works of a similar type. And obviously they don't really fit in the same way, because he was thinking about One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich kind of as an adventure, because he says that he's having a really excellent day in the gulag. So he's in this terrible context, obviously, but that's something that Starrett kind of realized or like came to terms with on readings that were a bit later in life, but also held on to these small joys that are so much a part of the book.
Well, I'm afraid time is short. We're going to have to let you go, Alice. But before you do, we cannot let you go without you talking very briefly about your lovely podcast piece in the Arts Pages. I think we're going to do a teaser for it, and people are going to have to read the piece for themselves. But tell us very briefly what you are talking about.
Okay, so I'm looking at two podcasts, both of which, I suppose, look around queer culture. One of them is quite wide. They talk about a lot of academic things as well as kind of bad dates, and then relate a lot from that in either queer theory or you know, just advice for the world, and that's Food for Thought, which calls itself the lower back tattoo of the podcast world. And then there's Wheels on Fire, which is more on the kind of queer villainy side in a tongue-in-cheek way, which looks absolutely fabulous. And it's three friends watching it over again and their observations.
Well, there you have it from Alexander Solzhenitsyn to absolutely fabulous. Alice Wordsworth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now to an article by Anna Aslanian, who writes this week about a book called Journey Through a Tragicomic Century, The Absurd Life of Hasso Grabner by Francis Nenick, translated from the German by Katie Derbyshire. We suspect there's a good story coming when we read the very first line of Anna's review. Facts, once established, can be more fascinating than anything imagination might conjure. Hasso Grabner's story is, she suggests, the proof of this. Anna Aslanian joins us on the line now to tell us more. Anna, hello, and thanks for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Let's start with some facts then. Can you give us the bare bones of Hasso Grabner's life?
Hasso Grabner was born in 1911 in Leipzig in Germany. And there's little that's known about his childhood, except that he grew up without a father and he lost his mother quite early. By the age of 15, he was, Francis Nenick says, almost an old hand in politics. In fact, he never finished school. He went straight into bookselling and, more importantly, into revolutionary activities. And in the summer of 1934, Grabner was arrested along with a number of his comrades, and he got 4 years in prison for preparation of high treason, which in fact meant that they just distributed some anti-Nazi leaflets. Anyhow, he got 4 years, and then upon release was immediately sent to Buchenwald, where he spent 2 years working as a librarian. So then the war started, and Grabner, like many political prisoners, was drafted into a penal battalion. He then spent most of the war in Corfu, in Greece. And then after the war, Grabner lived in the GDR. To quote Nenick's punchy prose again, he jacked through all trades. So he did all sorts of things. At one point, he was put in charge of the country's entire steel industry. And then he kept oscillating between managing large industrial projects and working on the production line.
And he was writing a lot throughout this time.
Yes, as if all these developments and the sisters weren't enough to keep him busy, he also became a prolific author in the process. And he published poetry, plays, novels. Although eventually, after yet another falling out with the party and with the authorities, they stopped publishing him. He died in 1976 and was soon forgotten by most.
Did he ever write about his own life? Because it just seems absolutely extraordinary that list of things that happened to him and that he did. Did he write about himself, or was it all fiction? And
Funnily enough, he didn't actually document his life himself, which today in our age of autofiction seems a bit incredible. But to quote Nenick, somewhere in the book, he says, some make history and others rewrite it. So in Nenick's view, Grabner knew that presumably suspected that any attempt to write history would be then subject to been rewritten again. So he just concentrated on fiction.
He's been strongly anti-Nazi his whole life, but you got an Iron Cross. Is that right? You got an Iron Cross for bravery within the German army. And then he could start a fight in an empty room, no matter what system he was in. Is that right?
that's a very good way to put it. And getting that Iron Cross, I think it's one of the most absurd things in his life, which by any kind of standard was full of absurdities. So he was in the penal battalion. So again, there wasn't, he was drafted into it, and he had no choice there. Then they started retreating. And at one point, this company was attacked in the middle of the night. So they fought, he stabbed someone. And the next morning he saw that the man he killed with his bayonet had a red star on his hat. And Grabner secretly removed that star. Now, we don't know what he actually thought when he stood there holding that star in one hand and the medal he received for his bravery in the other. So all we know is that his journey actually began with a red star. You know, those stars appeared on the communist leaflets he once produced and distributed to protest against Nazism. That was what brought him here. And now he is marching on with a Nazi medal on his chest, while in his pocket is a red star from the hat of a killed enemy.
The facts are not many. There's not a lot of corroborating stuff. If you were going to write a conventional biography, you would need more than this, I suppose. But Nenek, you say he turns a paucity of information about his subject into an advantage. He uses history to bring each discovered detail into focus. So can you give us an example of what he's doing, something to illustrate how this works in practice?
Yeah, for instance, to begin with, the backstory of this project. Nenek says in his afterword that he was actually interested in forgotten writers, and he almost set himself a set of rules. So one of the prerequisites for his project was that there should be no secondary literature and no Wikipedia entry for the writers he's going to write about. So, and then he had to kind of optimize the balance between finding absolutely nothing and at least having some sources at his disposal. Then he came across an article about Grabner, which was dedicated to his centenary, I think. And he said bingo, although in actual fact, it wasn't a bingo at all, because there was just a mere outline of his biography, which ended with, how could such a personality have been forgotten? So Nenek begins to sift through documents which are scattered all over different archives. He collects oral testimonies and letters. He finds specialists who help him find documents on Buchenwald, on the war, on the post-war GDR. So he gets access to his subject's diaries, letters, other writings. This is, as you quite rightly pointed out, still not enough. So he needs to try and contextualize some of those facts, at least. And he does what most writers would do. He reads all newspapers and tries to reconstruct the world that surrounded Grabner, the very century that first produced him and then swallowed him without a trace.
I've seen this book described as a novel, elsewhere as a biography. In another place, it was a memoir. Would you venture a label of your own? I mean, I know these labels aren't really important, but it is, I think, interesting to know how and why they're being played with, because presumably there's some kind of theory on Nenek's part about what history is, I suppose.
The publisher, B&Q Books, defines this as a thrilling slice of narrative nonfiction, and I can't see any problem with that. But if I had to coin my own term, I'd probably call it a bio-novel, which is to say a biography that could easily be a novel, but prefers not to. Nenek's take on history writing is, he just calls it basically speculative fiction, which I suppose to an extent might be true. So he himself chooses a path which is kind of somewhere between history and fiction.
There's something quite surprising, I suppose, this is a book about an obscure German industrialist come writer. So it's kind of surprising, I suppose, that Nenek's style, it's quite chatty, isn't it? It's quite chatty and humorous.
Yeah, it's very, very ironic. I'd say he balances between being metaphorical and ironic. His prose is very punchy. For instance, he says things like Grabner's future is gradually ticking away, attempting to tiptoe past him unnoticed, while the whole socialist thing is trundling along. Or in his anti-war resistance, Grabner takes on the powerful role of a single spanner, realizing every day anew that it would take a whole battery of toolboxes to stop the machinery for even a second. So there is kind of a metaphorical, quite heavy, sometimes even ponderous sentences. So I think these ponderous sentences are just another example of Nenek's irony, an attempt to parody this grand style, which is typical for much of 20th century discourse, to take that century down a peg, to put the comic back in a tragic comic.
I was going to say, do you think it's he's attempting to enact in the narrative some of the absurdity of what's going on in Grabner's life?
Very much so. I think that's precisely what his project is about. And he dedicates all his writerly skills to that. He will happily forego some of the kind of special effects that he might have brought in. And we've already said something about his reluctance to be a novelist, to use novelistic devices, but he just tweaks his own style in order the better to reflect what was happening and how absurd and how grotesque much of it was.
Mm. Oh, and I mean, you're a translator, indeed you're writing history of translation, aren't you? So I mean, you must appreciate how hard it is to convey, I mean, not only the humour and the kind of, I mean, humour being so culturally specific in many cases, but also the idiosyncrasies of the style and the structures from the German into the English. This must be a joy to you to see this being done by a new publishing house, I suppose, as well.
Yes, absolutely. First of all, a couple of words about the publishing house. Vinkyu Books is the English language imprint recently founded by Katie Derbyshire, who translated this book. And their aim is to promote German literature in the Anglophone world, and more generally and more urgently to foster links between the UK and Europe, which is something we need now more than ever. I've read the first few titles from VNQ, and I look forward to reading more. And what you asked about translation, one of the points I make in my book, which is a popular history of translation and is finished now, will be out in May. But I wrote it partly to discuss this point, that there is no such thing as word-for-word translation. It seems to be an obvious point, but people often overlook it. And also another interesting phenomenon is that literary translators can roughly be divided into two schools. So one school works on the principle that you have to, as a translator, you have to try to stay invisible. And the other says that it's okay to actually leave your mark. So the first school is traditionally quite strong in Anglophone countries. The translator's brief seems to be, just give us a text that reads smoothly in English. Who cares what language it's been translated from? Who cares what kind of peculiarities the original has? Whereas the other school insists that a translation should bear some kind of foreign marks. Some foreign features should still be visible. Now, I don't see these principles as irreconcilable. In fact, I think translation is all about searching for a golden mean between these two extremes. And that's precisely why I admire Katie Derbyshire's work, particularly this translation. I should say straight away that I haven't read the original. My German is quite basic. But her version in itself is enough to convince me that she manages to strike the right balance by, on the one hand, making the text very fluid, while at the same time retaining some of its foreignness, in the sense that if you pick up this book, you are unlikely to think that it was originally written in English. So, and then irony, as a potential challenge for translators. In fact, some translators, including myself, see irony as a welcome challenge. It kind of keeps you on your toes, and it encourages you to be inventive. And it seems to be that Derbyshire also takes this challenge on happily, and she deals with it brilliantly.
I spotted another book on the website by Isabel Bogdan. It's translated by Annie Rutherford. And it just, in terms of a publishing project, it just sounds so interesting. This particular book is called The Peacock. Is this one of the ones that you've read maybe, Anna?
No, unfortunately.
Okay, well, it's summarized as follows, and if you haven't read it yet, you might want to after this. It says, take a dilapidated castle in the Scottish Highlands, add a peacock gone rogue, a group of bankers on a team building trip, an overwhelmed psychologist, a housekeeper with a broken arm, and an ingenious cook. Get Lord and Lady Mackintosh to try and keep it all together and top it off with all sorts of animals. Soon no one will know exactly what's going on. It sounds brilliant. It sounds like a film collaboration between like Yorgos Lanthimos and Paolo Sorrentino or something.
Sounds like a really good holiday.
Doesn't it? Exhausting.
Yeah.
No, it also sounds very energetic. I think the few titles published by this new imprint, they kind of have this energy, at least to me. They brought in this very welcome note of something punchy, energetic, I think that's what good literature should be like.
Yeah, absolutely. They say they plan to burst plenty of myths, including the one about the Germans having no sense of humour.
Well, I think this book has already done quite a lot towards that, because you really chuckle quite a lot. Every page is full of puns, jokes, ironic statements. So, yeah, it's as subtle and as funny as can be.
Well, all of which is to say, I think we can all agree that we are looking forward to more.
Absolutely.
Anna Aslanyan, many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Anne Pettifor, Alice Wadsworth and Anna Aslanyan. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Lee Meyer. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.